Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Later in the program, Byron Callen of Capital Alpha Partners with a look at what's ahead for this short but important week. But first, every year, some of the world's leading international security officials, analysts, thinkers, and reporters descend on Halifax, the capital of Nova Scotia, for the annual Halifax International Security Forum. It's always an honor to cover the conference, but sadly this year, because of the coronavirus pandemic, the event was online. That said, it was still a terrific gathering that focused on the importance of democratic nations coming together to solve problems that are too big for any of them to solve on their own, and issued a great handbook on how democracies should deal with China, called China versus Democracy, the Greatest Game. Each year, it's my honor to talk to Canada's Minister of National Defense, Harjit Sajjan, who joins us today. Sir, thanks very much for the time, and sorry we didn't get to see each other in person this year.
Oh, likewise. But COVID will be over, and then look forward to meeting you in person again.
Absolutely. It's a great town, and I'm sorry they got robbed of a little bit of the revenue, unfortunately, that everybody up there looks forward to at the end of each year. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Over the past 4 years, Canada has worked hard to be the voice of democracy and international cooperation and leadership that many feel the United States ceded. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau gave a passionate address at Halifax about the need for nations to come together to penalize those who break international laws, standards, and norms. And he powerfully said that they do it because they're getting away with it. To Canada's credit, it's raised this voice, even as others have been more muted, to the admiration of many around the world. Over the past 4 years, while military cooperation between Washington and Ottawa have been strong, Washington has subjected Canada to tariffs and other trade actions. There's a new American administration that's coming to power in January. What are Ottawa's priorities with America in 2021 and beyond?
Well, first of all, I mean, our priorities are to enhance our relationship. And I've always said the relationship between Canada and the U.S. are beyond any Canadian government or U.S. administration. It's been built by our members of our armed forces who have fought on the battlefield. And we have participated together in every war or NATO operation that has existed. And we'll continue to work together on the importance of growing our economies. Our number one priority right now is how do we together work and deal with this pandemic, the importance of the environment, and also making sure that we keep our citizens safe through our a very trusted binational relationship that we've had for a very long time. And NORAD is that really good example, and how we can use this as an opportunity to be able to work together internationally, as we have done, whether it's in Ukraine, in against sanctions monitoring against North Korea, or as part of the coalition.
One of the clear messages of the forum was that China is in a battle for ideas and trying to portray democracies as failures to bolster its case for authoritarianism, pointing in particular to the failure of the United States and Europe to contain COVID, touting its success in breaking the virus. Canada has done a far, far better job than the United States and other nations have, even though cases are rising. Beating COVID is Joe Biden's number one priority at home. For very good reason, given 250,000 Americans have been killed and many more are likely to die before vaccines take effect. But breaking the disease internationally also makes a case for democracies. Is COVID a key battle that democracies are now losing? And if so, what's the right international approach that combines all the arms of national power and powers to do this and to do it right?
Well, first of all, the COVID pandemic is the number one priority of every nation, and it should be. But also, this pandemic should not be in any way to judge democracies. Democracies are built over time, evolve through its people and the choices that they make. And it cannot be subverted because somebody assesses how a pandemic is being managed. So I would caution anybody to to make a judgment on democracies because of this pandemic. What the democracies allow for is citizens to have a voice, to making sure that depending how a country is set up, especially like Canada, we are a nation made up of provinces and territories that also have a voice. And it's very important to making sure that democracies flourish, and they will. Any example in history when any type of conflict or adversity comes up, we have seen that democracies do come through together because always the people have that power. And we can never forget that. And we shouldn't allow, as I stated earlier, a pandemic to judge how democracies are functioning.
What's the best, you know, Canadian Armed Forces have been engaged, obviously, in Canada, U.S. Armed Forces, National Guard, in our case in particular. But Canada has always tried to look at security issues through a much broader and a much more integrated lens, something I think which the United States, United Kingdom are all working toward that kind of broader approach. What do you think are some of the things and ways cooperation will go, given that an American administration is going to play clearly a more multinational, multilateral approach to security than the Trump administration did?
Well, first of all, I think the U.S. plays always a very important role around the world. And in Canada, we will be also looking at the how we respond, to this pandemic. We were very fortunate that we conducted a very thorough defense policy review that has allowed us to be set up appropriately to respond. But at the same time, we use every opportunity like this to look at what are the changes that we need to make. And I think countries around the world have are assessing their supply chain management, and not just from a defense perspective, but in a totality for its entire nation. What it allows us to take a look at is making sure that we have supply chain resilience in our own nation, but complementary to one another. And this pandemic has reminded us of this. And so moving forward, we have already started discussions with other nations, especially with my counterparts, on supply chain resilience. So this is another way of demonstrating how we can further our relationships with one another, and the defense supply chain is extremely important to making sure that we maintain those through challenges like a pandemic.
One of the key messages that also came out of Halifax was the need for democracies to come together to both counter, but also to cooperate with China. That was a tremendous video where it showed how powerful the elephant is against the lion until you realize there are 30 lions. And I think the case was that even if China thinks itself as being able to be big enough and bully everybody, there are a lot of countries that if they come together are able to exert that pressure. Joe Biden wants to convene democracies to counter China's malign global influence. You're from Vancouver, a very, very important city for what is also a Pacific middle power. What's the right way ahead to both counter China's malign influence, which Canada has also felt, but also constructively cooperate with China?
Well, I think if you look at our history, we've had difficult relationships with nations that evolve over time. And through those relationships, you have disagreements on certain aspects and agreements in another. And the goal is always is to emphasize your agreements and work on your disagreements. But when they start to impact the international rules-based order, well, that gets obviously problematic. And one thing that Canada has always done, and actually has demonstrated this quite recently, even during the Trump administration, how we can help convene nations to come together and send a very strong message of diplomacy. But diplomacy can only happen if you take the appropriate actions as well. So the example that I have given quite often is when our foreign affairs minister hosted the foreign affairs ministers from all the nations that were involved in the Korean War to talk about the challenges that North Korea has been, creating on security for many nations. And through that, myself and Secretary Mattis were actually at that meeting. We agreed to increase our presence in the sanctions monitoring against North Korea. And in fact, one of our ships just completed one of its tasks, and our surveillance aircraft is currently there. Through those military actions allows our diplomacy to be much stronger. And that's what we need to do right now moving forward, is to be able to demonstrate that if a nation starts creating this unpredictability and causing anxiety, especially security challenges, that the rest of the world will not stand for it. And this is why it is very important for democratic nations to come together to be able to send a very strong message, something that we have done a number of times throughout history, and we look forward to doing it again.
You mentioned the international order and pressure. Obviously, China is a great power, the largest power in this new era of great power competition. And that sparked a debate about the role for smaller missions, counterterrorism missions like Afghanistan and Iraq. And obviously, the American administration, this administration, is looking to draw down U.S. forces rather steeply. There are some voices in this administration who maintain the United States should pull out of all of these areas in order to better focus on the China challenge, for example. There are others who counter, though, that one of the reasons we're forward is to prevent acts of terrorism from coming to our shores. What's the right balance in this era, sir, given that you're a veteran of the Afghanistan campaign? What's the right balance here in terms of forward engagement on these wars that are long and slow and hard? And then the great power challenge, which is increasingly standing up to the likes of Russia, North Korea, and China.
Well, first of all, I mean, I'll stay out of the political debate in the U.S., but what I'll give you our Canadian perspective is when we conducted our defense policy review, we looked at all the challenges and what type of Canadian armed forces do we need? Are we going to be ready for conventional warfare? Do we need to be how we do support with NATO? What about the challenges, for example, with conquering ISIS is another challenge. And for us, you have to do it all. Because just imagine where we were before 9/11. 9/11 changed that. And obviously, nations have had to act. And at that time, nations came together and NATO supported the U.S. And we went in together into Afghanistan. A threat needed to be dealt with. And we obviously worked collaboratively and lost a lot of our nation's treasure in Afghanistan. And we're very proud of the work that we did there. As we were looking at for example, with the challenges that Russia has created in this world when it comes to the illegal annexation of Crimea or what they're doing in Donbass. Those are all challenges that we have to be able to manage as well. At the same time, we had ISIS flourishing in the Middle East. Those are challenges that we dealt with. So the answer is you can't just make a thing. We can't pick either or, because ultimately the safety of your citizens is the number one priority. So you have to do it all. So now the real challenge for all of us is to look at what type of security architecture does your nation have and what do the role that the armed forces play. And for us, we have to remain agile. We need to be able to making sure that we continue to invest in our capabilities that sends a very strong message to any strong power out there that's willing to start pushing their boundaries like China and Russia. While at the same time, be agile enough to be able to support United Nations operations, whether it's in Africa, sanctions monitoring, or a new threat that might emerge out there. And let's not forget, a threat that no one had predicted, but we had prepared for, at least in the military, is a health pandemic. So we have to do it all. Right. You can't just pick and choose, because ultimately, you're responsible. You're responsible for the safety of your citizens, and there is no way out of that. And you got to make sure that everything is done appropriately.
Let me ask you one last question, which is modernization. Obviously, Canada's is underway with an ambitious recapitalization program. Obviously, new Type 26 frigates on order. There is a comprehensive modernization of NORAD that you're investigating as you seek also new fighters, new fighter aircraft. bring us up to speed on those key modernization efforts that are important, not just from a Canadian perspective in the high north, for example, which is likely to become more contested, certainly by Russia, but also as part of the foundation for Canada as a global power?
Well, I think for us right now, what we're focused on is to making sure that we put the right investments into the Canadian Armed Forces. So we're looking at, have already started to modernize all our three services, from the Army, our Air Force, and from our Navy, and some of the projects that you had mentioned. But let's not forget some of the systems that are also required to make those capabilities up to the level of expectations that we want them. So, for example, the R&D money that we're putting in is quite significant to making sure that we develop the new technologies to be able to deal with threats. Organize Canadian Armed Forces to be able to match the capabilities that are going to be needed out there. So, for example, the ships are going to be building, as we say, the captain is not even born yet. And so we have to look way into the future of looking at how we're going to be able to train our people. So modernization is not just a technology anymore. It's about how we train our people. So we're putting a lot of emphasis on looking after our people, so making sure that they have the right mindset, that they feel looked after, and that they're going to be able to take care of those capabilities. NORAD modernization is a key priority for us, and we put that in the defense policy for a reason, because our defense policy is fully costed and carved out of the fiscal framework. So it means it's fully funded for the next 20 years. And because NORAD modernization requires us to work with the U.S. to come up with a plan, we purposely left that separate, because we wanted to, again, have the same credibility as we did it for the defense policy, which is we'll work with the U.S., look at coming up with a plan, cost it out, put the money aside, and that way we're going to make sure that it's going to be properly invested, because at the end of the day, Canadian and U.S. sovereignty is extremely important in the North. And then when you look at in its totality, North American defense is something that we're kind of looking at now as a broader aspect of NORAD modernization.
And what is that broader aspect? It's interesting you said that. How do you see this in a broader context?
Well, so if you look at the threats that we face, it can't be just your traditional threats that we've seen before. For example, ballistic missiles. We have to look at cyber. We got to look at maritime domain awareness. We have to take a look at other type of activities that can be used as well. So we want to be very broad. So the analysis is happening right now, but those are some of the things that we're looking at. But let's not forget space as well. So the way I describe it is, we need to be ready from, if you look all the way from space all the way to underwater, and not just look at the Arctic itself. We have to take a look at, as you know, if you want to be defense, just doesn't start at the line where your continental boundary, nation's boundary starts or ends. It's about making sure that you can project outwards as well. So all that analysis is being done, and that's what we look at North American defense, because right now it's Canada and U.S. working very closely together, and we have evolved NORAD multiple times, and this is another opportunity to take it to the whole new level.
Sir, thanks very much for always being so generous with your time. We really, really appreciate it. Hope you have terrific and safe holidays, and looking forward to engaging again soon. Thanks so very much for joining us.
Great. Thank you. Nice talking to you.
And joining us now, as he does most Mondays, is my good friend Byron Callan of Capital Alpha Partners. Byron, thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, great to be here, Vago.
Always a pleasure. A short week, but a big week, as I said at the top of the show. Obviously, Team Biden is going to be announcing its picks. We've got Ron Klain, who's going to be obviously the chief of staff, with Tony Blinken to be nominated as President-elect Biden's future Secretary of State, Jake Sullivan to become National Security Advisor, and one of America's distinguished diplomats, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, to become the United States Ambassador to the United Nations, re-elevated to a cabinet position as opposed to something that current Secretary of State Mike Pompeo subordinated to the State Department. That having been said, what's on your mind, right? When we had the Afghanistan news flow last week, what else is on your mind, Byron?
Well, I mean, obviously this week, it's actually seeing those announcements through. After that, you know, the Biden team is going to pretty much leave us all to our Thanksgiving shopping preparations and probably limited social gatherings. But I kind of look at it in three ways. First, all the speculation that Susan Rice would be nominated as Secretary of State. Look, I think she's obviously a highly competent person, but it would have entailed a very bruising Senate confirmation battle. And that's not to say that you won't see bruising confirmation battles with the Senate and the GOP majority in any event, but I think Rice could have been something of a lightning rod, and maybe Blinken less so. Second point, you know, from a defense standpoint, there's nothing on the public record that would suggest these people are going to be pushing U.S. policies that would easily allow the country to make the sort of worst case defense spending cuts that people had been baiting around earlier in the year, the kind of 10% out of the box cut when the Biden administration comes into office. I mean, they've tagged China as our leading competitor. Russia certainly is up there. I just don't see anything that's foundationally different, although the tone and the approach will be different than what we've seen in the Trump administration. And I think the third point, this is going to be kind of interesting, where to thread the needle for defense will go. Both Sullivan and Blinken have been on record with kind of a more expansive view of U.S. security, this idea that we really need to spend time first fixing our problems at home. So more emphasis on basic research and development, more emphasis on good jobs, if you build that foundational strength, then you're going to have a more robust and powerful international policy. So, you know, how that fits in with defense, defense is generally provides pretty good jobs relative to many other sectors of the economy. It is something, you know, where potentially there may be some nuances in how research and development spending is allocated or reallocated. Are there ways for the defense sector to help participate in that? Those are the kind of preliminary thoughts on these announcements. I don't think they're in any way, shape, or form negative for defense, but I'm looking for some of the silver linings, some of the positives too out of this.
It's funny because Liam Fox, former UK International Trade Secretary, former UK Defense Secretary, has always said, I think, very thoughtfully, that security begins in the home and extends all the way up to international security, that if people don't feel secure economically, if people don't feel secure physically, if people don't feel secure medically, it's very hard for them to become engaged in international security. And governments have to handle all this entire spectrum and set the conditions for success across that piece, which appears to be how Team Biden is approaching it. There has been some reporting about other positions across government, including for some people who we've known for a very long time. But what's your sense on some of those other positions, whether it's for deputy secretary, whether it's for, on acquisition jobs as well as service secretaryships? I mean, is there anything that indicates... Right, because there's an expectation that this new administration is going to be making much, much, much more serious trade-offs that this administration avoided, right? I mean, we're going to make tough trade-offs next year, and it appears that next year has arrived, and it falls to this administration to, as Michelle Flournoy has repeatedly said, she still remains the leading contender for defense secretary, to make some real bets.
Well, yeah. Right?
So what do we know about the team and where they're likely to take us?
Well, Frank Kendall's name has come up. I don't have a good bead yet on some of the other, secretarial positions or research or acquisition and sustainment, but I think looking at where at least Flournoy is and, the fact that she's worked very closely with Tony Blinken, they had a consultancy together. So I don't think I'd be surprised if you see people kind of way out of left field coming in who would have significantly different views than this leadership. I do think the trick, will be, and admittedly, the Trump administration did try and make some pretty big changes. Now, so did the Obama administration. You go back and look at efforts to, for example, retire Ticonderoga class cruisers early. I think the more key effort by the Trump administration may have been to truncate the refueling on the Truman, an aircraft carrier, and that got rolled back by Congress. So the real issue for me is, you can propose these things, but ultimately you've got to convince Congress that this is the right path to take. And there are not a lot of votes for the future in Congress. I mean, people are kind of concerned about the military units, the jobs that are in their districts and states. And that's really the hardest lift in this is an administration can propose these major cuts to systems, weapon systems, military units that may be deemed less relevant or frankly obsolete or obsolescent in Asian or even a highly contested environment in Eastern Europe. But, those are very, very heavy lifts. And I think it's going to be intriguing to see, how a Biden Department of Defense can really get those things through, because ultimately that's where the rubber's going to meet the road is, will Congress approve these sorts of changes?
Historically, Congress can go along with decisions or Congress can kill decisions, necessary decisions in defense. And that's especially true when it comes to trade-offs and capability. It took a Bob Gates and an Obama administration coming in to, for example, kill the F-22. We can debate the merits of whether it should or should not have been done, but it was F-22, ABL for the airborne laser, future combat systems. And then there were dozens of other programs that were terminated as no longer deemed relevant for where the United States was going. Just like now, there are a whole series of heritage programs that folks are weighing and assessing. Adam Smith, the House Armed Services Committee chairman, Mike Gallagher, Angus King, right? Anybody that I've interviewed or talked to, both on and off the record, members say, look, if the case is made in the right way, it's possible to do that. Jim Banks has said that. Seth Moulton repeated that not too long ago on this very program about the need for trade-offs. How do folks need to be thinking about the period we're going into? Because there may not be more defense spending, right? I mean, the assumption of this administration has been that there would always be more money, or at least somewhat more money, and very, very ambitious plans and some talks of trade-offs, for example, getting to 500 ships, for example. Whereas there is the reality of the fiscal situation, right? How do folks need to be thinking through this period we're going into, whether they're in industry, whether they're in leadership in the administration, or whether they're in Congress?
Thing that I think is most important is what is the future of war going to look like? And I think once you start from that assumption or that set of assumptions, and obviously it's not a war, it's going to be what are the future of war is going to look like. And then you can start building back into what I don't like the term legacy, because frankly, you could argue the B-52 is a legacy weapons system that's going to be around for another, 20, 30, 40 years. I mean, it really has some very important roles to fulfill. But I think you have to think about, the ranges in Asia Pacific and how they contrast to a military that was really built primarily with a conflict in Central Europe in mind. So shorter range aircraft, F-16s, the idea that, you now have precision weapons that can really put out of commission in fairly short order major air bases or ports. So there's a lot of thinking, obviously, that's been going on in this in the Department of Defense. Has it all translated into a resource alignment? No. But to your point, I think that's what the Biden administration hopefully will kind of pick that ball up and really run with it. Now, a lot of the programs that you mentioned, Future Combat System, I could go on, Comanche, things like that, they were future programs that really didn't have a constituency yet. When you start talking about cutting, let's say you're going to cut your F-16 force, those are usually, you know, the older aircraft are going to be National Guard units. And you can see the hue and cry that goes up when these older units are disbanded, or they're converted to UAVs or some other, there's an immediate economic impact. So maybe the other thing that people ought to be thinking through or watching is, you know, to what extent does the Biden administration try and link these decisions with other broader economic goals? And I only think about it, Vago, because you and I have both been to Newport, Rhode Island, and that used to be a major destroyer base, right? So somehow there are parts of the country that have made this transition, San Francisco Bay Area, New York Harbor. You know, there's a ship, naval ship construction in Boston, and these major metropolitan areas have been able to absorb the job cuts that have accompanied the shutdown of some of these bases. The trick, I think, is going to be moving into states where these sorts of facilities are much more important economically. And so I think that's something that I would watch is, you know, is there a more comprehensive approach than just DOD releasing a budget request and plan that suggests here's all the things we're going to do. There has to be a whole of government effort. And I think that's how you might start to get buy-in. I think there's a recognition of the threat. But again, you know, people are only going to go so far. They're not going to get reelected in 2022 or 2024 or 2026 if, you know, they see the kind of local impacts on their constituents that some of these cuts can entail.
Let me ask you one last question, and that's about Afghanistan. How did you interpret the administration's reductions? What do they mean at the end of the day? And how permanent are they, right? I mean, at the top of this show, we heard from Canada's Minister of National Defense, Harjit Sajjan, who said, look, I mean, at the end of the day, this is not an either-or choice. It's not like we have to do great power competition or Afghanistan or Iraq or a pandemic. He's like, we're in the business of national security as part of an integrated national team. We've got to be able to do all of this or we're sort of not doing our jobs. What's your sense? Because there is this prevalent tone in the administration, you know, we have to focus on great power competition and it's time for us to get out of these small wars. And the reality is some of these places pick you. You don't pick them.
Well, that's the fallacy of the whole great power competition. This great power competition has always taken place through proxies. All great power go back to the Vietnam War, you know, okay, kind of a local conflict in many ways, but, you know, go tell the Air Force pilots who were flying over Vietnam North Vietnam, that was a low intensity conflict. So this idea, and back to Afghanistan, how do I view it? I mean, I think it's something that might be reversed. But I think it's going to really depend on events. Biden had run in part on the notion that we're going to end these forever wars, but I don't think he talked about let's just skedaddle and leave the Afghans to figure this out for themselves. So my concern would be that it's something that really gets overtaken by events. And, you know, we've seen that movie before in 1974, 1975 in Vietnam, where, you know, if all of a sudden the stakes start to go up much higher because the Taliban do make significant inroads against Afghan security forces and or their U.S. casualties, and you get this attitude in the United States that, you know, enough, that's it. Then you're going to have to start walking through, well, what are the unintended consequences of that? Everything from opium production to what does it mean for the stability of Pakistan if you have an unstable Afghanistan next door when, you know, there are multiple tactical nuclear warheads in Pakistan's possession. And that could be a very, very different security problem that could play out in the 2020s if you're not careful. So I get the frustration, the length, you know, we poured blood and treasure in Afghanistan. No one wants to write that investment off. as much as there's a belief that we should do so. I think at some point we ought to just stand back and say, what's more at stake here? And not just focus on, we've done this for 18 years, enough is enough, let's get out.
Byron, thanks very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. And if you can't join us again this week, hope you and yours have a terrific Thanksgiving and looking forward to having you back on after the holiday. Thanks again.
You too, Vago. Cheers.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.